Ian, you can get me a glass of water, could you? Cheers, thank you.
Well, you might remember some of you when you were young. Some of you are young. Hello. Maybe you were told by your parents, you need to study hard at school. Some of you are parents, some of us are parents, and we're saying that now, where you need to work hard at school, you need to do well, you need to do well so you can go to university, so that you can get a good job and have a good life. Maybe you've been talking, hearing that, and talking in that way. I heard that. You make me laugh. Don't interrupt. You're making me laugh. It is right. You are right. But Solomon, obviously, had achieved this and that as well. He'd achieved all of these things, hadn't he? What does Bob say? Yours is not a speaking part. And Solomon has achieved this. He has had a good education. He has done well. He was wise already, wasn't he? And then God asked him what he wanted, and he asked for wisdom, and God gave him wisdom. So I've been suggesting that he was the wisest man in the world after Jesus himself. And he had certainly done well for himself as the king, thank you, as the king of Israel. And he seems to me to be looking back now at the end of his life, screaming out at younger people in particular, people who are at school perhaps, or at university, studying hard to get a degree in order to get a job, to start a career, to do well at work, maybe to start a business in order to make money and do well in life, believing that if we do all those things, our lives will have meaning and purpose. And that's what parents want for their children, isn't it? They want them to do well at school, to get a good job, so that their life might have meaning and purpose. That's why we nag our children. Will you do some revision? Will you do your homework? Nevertheless, the question tonight I want to ask is the point of life simply to have a really impressive and well-polished CV? Maybe you're not working, maybe you're retired, maybe you're not working in a paid job, maybe you have volunteer work, or you work in the church or something like that. It's all the same. It's the point of life to have and to get meaning from working and from education. So we're going to look at those two things this evening. Solomon's making two points in these verses, Ecclesiastes 2:12 to 23. And then he brings a note of optimism in verses 24, 25 and 26. But two points in verses 12 to 16, or even 12 to 17 actually, and then verses 18 to 23. The first point is this: life is complicated. Is there any point studying hard to figure it out? Life is complicated. Is there any point studying hard to figure it all out? So let's just go through these verses and see what he does. So verse 12, notice that Solomon begins, well, he's already conducting an experiment on the meaning of life, if you like, the point of life. And here he narrows his experiment down somewhat. Verse 12, I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. So Solomon's mini experiment in the context of his big experiment is to see which is better, wisdom or madness and folly. And Solomon is so wise, he can do mad things and foolish things wisely with an eye to the wisdom that he has been given. So he said, I'm going to compare wisdom and foolishness. It's a great theme throughout the wisdom literature books. Read Proverbs, read Job. It's about wisdom and foolishness. And so this is his experiment. Now in verses 13 and the first part of verse 14, he comes to a conclusion. Verse 13, I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in the darkness. So he conducts this experiment and he says it is better to be wise. It is better to have an education. Remember, he's talking about life under the sun, as we see it from our perspective. He's saying it is better to conduct life with wisdom rather than foolishness. You've heard the phrase before. It's often used by atheists against Christians, actually. But Solomon turns the fool, the atheist argument on his head, and he uses their arguments to disprove their theories and ideas. But you've probably heard that foolishness is like a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there. Foolishness is like a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there. Now, as I say, often atheists talk about Christians being like that, looking for gods. But Solomon turns all of this worldly wisdom on its head and uses it against the foolish. He says it's better to be wise than to be foolish. But there's a problem with his conclusion. Look at the second half of verse 14. I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both, the wise and the foolish. There is a problem with his conclusion, because the conclusion raises more questions. Both wise and foolish people are going to meet the same fate. They're both going to die. Look at verse 15a. He asks himself the question, I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will also overtake me. What then do I gain by being wise? So his conclusion is to the problem he sets out that wisdom is better, but the conclusion only raises more questions. If the wise and the foolish are both going to die, what's the point of being wise? What's the point of learning stuff and finding things out? So in verses 15 and 16, he draws another conclusion. So start 15 again. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What do I gain by being wise? Conclusion, I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. So the second conclusion is wisdom is meaningless because I'm going to die anyway. Verse 17 says this. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. So the conclusion he finally draws after setting out his experiment, drawing a conclusion which only raises more problems and questions, and then concludes that wisdom is meaningless, that conclusion has a consequence. I hate my life. I hate life. Ever been there? Any of you ever relate to that? I hate my life. I wish I was dead. What's the point of my existence? That's where Solomon got to as a consequence of his conclusion. I hate life. I hate life. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Not everybody has said that, but many people, particularly people of my generation, maybe, and particularly people of the generations of my children and your grandchildren, perhaps, are prone, aren't they, to say, I hate life. And maybe some of our young people are thinking that at the moment. You're sitting in what feels like the unfairness of it all, the awkwardness of it all, the frustration of it all. But we don't just have to be young people to be there, do we? We can often, many of us, relate to the fact that life is grim and it seems unfair. And Solomon got that. I hated life. Let's just recap so far the 4 weeks that we've been in Ecclesiastes. The first half of chapter 1, Solomon's conclusion was life is dull, dull, dull. Verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. Second half of chapter 2, his conclusion is life is crooked because we are crooked and we can't straighten crooked life out. Verse 15 says, what is twisted cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. And verse 18 says, for with much wisdom comes much sorrow, the more knowledge the more grief. So his decision in chapter 2 is, with those thoughts in mind, I'm going to have fun. I'm going to enjoy life. Verse 1 of chapter 2, I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But he found out the pleasure was meaningless and had no point. So now he says, okay, if messing around and having a laugh and a lark is meaningless, maybe I need to take seriously the pursuit of education and the pursuit of employment. And that's where he is just now in the part that we are in. So he says, I need to know more, I need to learn more, I need to study harder in chapter 2, 12 to 17, but I'm no better than a fool, so I give up. Just like a fool would give up. Nevertheless, chapter 2, verse 14 tells us that it is better to be wise, despite the fact that I'm going to die. It is a remarkable thing that in this day we are so clever. We are very blessed indeed, aren't we, to live when we live, knowing what we know, with the advances that we have in medical science, an understanding of the universe, of who we are, where we fit, and with a civilized kind of aspect to, most of the time, the way that we live. We're so blessed, aren't we, that education is so freely and wonderfully available. We have free education. You can go and do more qualifications throughout your life. You know, whatever age you are, you can go and learn more stuff. We really, really are blessed, and we should be thankful to Almighty God that we live in a time and we live in a nation where access to education is so readily available. I'm always really thrilled when one hears of Christian organizations that are going out into many third world countries to build schools and to encourage people into education, especially when such education has a Christian ethos to it. Maybe not always that explicitly, but very often with Christian mission churches going out and setting up schools in various parts of the world. You know what Solomon isn't saying? Don't bother studying. He's saying school is good, education is good, it's important. But the conclusion ultimately is we're all going to die. So life under the sun has to, if that's got a finiteness to it, there has to be something more, something else that's worth living for. Stephen Hawking died this week, didn't he? You saw that. Wow, what a genius. What a clever, clever, renowned man. His name will go on. Solomon says those who die aren't remembered, but it's, again, maybe because of the times that we're in, perhaps, but his name will go on for some generations, but ultimately he's now dead, and his name won't be remembered forever and ever. It'll be written in a history book somewhere until Jesus comes again, but increasingly what he's shown will perhaps, well, that's what it will pass on. Solomon says that the education is passed on, but the name, the individual isn't. Stephen Hawking died just as men of half, a quarter, a fraction of his intelligence are going to die. So Solomon seems to be saying, why bother knowing anything? Why bother doing anything? That's his first point in chapter 2, verses 12 to 17. So here's the second point. He goes on. We're told that we should work hard at school, first point. Second point is, in order to get a good job, in order to get a good job that we might do well, live well. So he examines this whole idea of work. Well, again, there's a similar sort of logic in the verses. We'll go through them. First of all, he lays out the problem that he has discovered. We saw that in verse 17, a bit of an overlap between the two subjects, education and work. His problem is, I hate my life now because work, the work that is done under the sun, remember we're looking at under the sun from man's perspective, not God's perspective, the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me, all of its meaningless chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. He identifies a problem. I work really hard, and because I'm going to die, somebody else is going to get all the things that I've got, all the stuff that I've enjoyed, everything else I'm going to get. Somebody else is going to get when I go because I can't take it with me. I can't take my stuff with me. Praise the Lord. But not everyone thinks in that way. You come up here, Cedric. You can do a better job than me today. We can't take it with us. It's good. But you know what? So many of the times we're accumulating stuff, and we think it's all about the stuff, And then we die and we can't take it with us. We realize that, don't we? We realize that. So that results in frustration. Look at verse 19. And who knows whether the one who gets all my stuff, whether he will be a wise man and or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the work into which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So in verse 19, he's utterly frustrated. Now, I don't know your families, but maybe your next of kin, well, obviously, you know, some of your next of kin, so be careful what I say, but maybe your next of kin is a complete and utter twit. Maybe they're off backpacking around some African country, doing stupid things, floundering their life away, flitting it all away, wasting time. And you know that when you die, you who've worked really hard are going to have to leave them all of your expensive stuff and they'll just squander it. So you end up thinking, I'm just going to leave everything to the local cattery because I don't want the fool in the family to get my gear. Solomon is incredibly frustrated. And so he draws another conclusion at the end of verse 19. It's meaningless. It's meaningless. And that then leads him, the frustration which concludes to his thesis of meaninglessness, leads in verse 20 to despair. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. He's talking about work and he's saying, he gets up Monday morning and he's saying, is it Friday yet? Is it Friday yet? Can you relate to despair in life? When is it Friday? So, verse 21, he gets his conclusion for work. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This, too, is meaningless and a great misfortune. Conclusion here is, I'm working for a load of gear, a load of stuff, I'm going to die, and then some twit will get all the stuff that I've worked really hard for. Seems to be fairly straightforward. The point he seems to be making for him is that work brings distress, despair, fear, angst, maybe a sense of foreboding. How many of you, I wonder, who are working or working voluntarily somewhere, perhaps dread work? Or maybe an aspect of work? Or you dread the meeting that's coming up at work this week? Many, many people do dread work, dread going into the office. When I was sort of towards the end of my secular career, I guess you could call it, I had a small team of people that I managed. And there was all sorts of different people on this team. There were some really lovely, lovely people who were on my team, but they were totally clueless. You'd spend so much time trying to train them up, encourage them, teach them the new computer system, explain to them this is the way we do it and this is why we do it, but they just couldn't grasp it. And management just got more and more frustrated with these people, but they were lovely people, you couldn't just sack them, they weren't doing anything wrong, but they just didn't grasp the whole system. And then on the other hand, there were people on my team who got it. Oh, wow, they got it. They were really, really hardworking. They brought in the business. But man, were they rebellious. Wow, did they want to cut the corners? Did they not want to follow the procedures, which I then had to account to my director for as to why they hadn't done all of that? They were just a law unto themselves. And they would just go off and do their own thing. Okay, they got the results at the end of the day, which meant I got paid my commissions. I didn't moan too much. But at the end of the day, wow, I would get home and I would be moan about these rebellious and clueless, at least in my opinion, people. It's not just work like that, though, is it? The things, the hobbies, the activities that we do as well cause us great frustration. The work that we do causes us great frustration. Just been and ordered a load more flat pack stuff from IKEA. Why do I do that to myself? It's coming in apparently on Easter Sunday. Easter Saturday. So we'll nip up to Norwich where it's being delivered to, come home, build this flat pack furniture, and I will get frustrated. Not with a person, but with MDF. I'll be reading the instructions and everything will be going well, and suddenly that bit of MDF that should fit into that groove there won't fit into that groove there. And I'll start talking to the MDF and saying, you are supposed to go into that groove there so that the screw there can fit in you. And I will get very frustrated with this piece of MDF and I will want to throw it out of the window. That kind of work is hard and wearisome. Maybe you like gardening. Maybe you're in the garden, you're digging the garden, but the garden is just full of stones and rubble. Why is all this rubble? And you get frustrated. Everything is hard. Work isn't as it's meant to be. You've seen Captain Mannering trying to bring into order a lean, mean fighting machine. And yet Sergeant Wilson just will not shout out the orders like a sergeant should. You've seen Captain Mannering getting frustrated with that stupid boy Pike because he just is clueless. You've seen Basil Fawlty with the hapless Manuel just at his wit's end, not just with his staff, but with his car as well, which is broken down as he gets a huge branch and just starts beating his car. It's funny, but it's so real, isn't it? Work is just frustrating, Solomon says. You know how my team members treated me, how Flatpak Furniture treats me, is very, very much how I treat God when it comes to work. You see, when God made the world, it was very good. And Adam was put into the world to work for God, and it was to be delightful, it was to be good. Adam was to tend the land and to extend the tamed earth where God would be able to be glorified and worshipped. But the earth was cursed because of man's rebellion and sin. When things don't go well for us at work, when we get frustrated or downbeaten, when we despair or fear going into the office the next day, it's as if God is saying, welcome to my world. Well, I don't despair and fear. God doesn't despair and fear. But how God has a right, would have a right, does have a right to get frustrated when we, his people, don't work for him as he has asked us to do. And yet, even though we complain about everyone and everything, and even in church, we complain about our fellow workers in church, don't we? God is so loving, so kind, and so compassionate. He puts up with me and with you as we fall short, as we frustrate him and his plans and his purposes as he wants us to work. God uses even that as a reminder to us that he loves us. But we need to remember that under the sun, life, the world, and our work is cursed, and it's not easy because of sin. And so in verse 23, Solomon says, all his days his work is pain and grief. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. How are you sleeping? How are you doing at night? Are you getting your 8 hours? Or are you lying awake, worrying about your toil? It'll sound familiar to many of you, perhaps. I can't sleep because I'm thinking about tomorrow. I'm worrying about my work. I'm worrying about the job. I'm worrying about the children who aren't working hard enough that they might get good results to go to university to get a degree, to work and get a good job. I just can't sleep. Well, don't despair. Don't despair. What should work be like if we lift our eyes above the sun? Just a couple of New Testament verses to encourage you. Some words of Jesus. You might want to just turn to these verses. John chapter 6. This is in the context of Jesus feeding the 5,000, and he's walked on water, and then he's going to give this lesson about how he's the bread of life. But John chapter 6, verses 27 to 29. John 6, 27 to 29. Jesus says, do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. On him, God the Father has placed his seal of approval. Then they asked him, what must we do to do the works God requires? Jesus answered, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. Oh, now, that's not so hard, is it? That's not so hard. That's not so wearisome. That's not so toilful. To believe in the one who who sent Jesus, to believe in Jesus, to believe in God. That's the work that God requires. And it is, it's not too simple or too straightforward to say that to do that work makes everything else under the sun fall into place, to bring meaning and purpose and fulfillment, not just to life in general, but even to your work and to your schooling. To work for the Lord is the very best thing. You know, I'm so grateful for those who work for the Lord in this church, who work hard after a hard day at work, will come out and run events or tidy up or do this or that or the other. I just want to put this out there as well, though. I wonder, some of you who work hard in your jobs and then come and work hard in the church. Oh, it's easy to say when you're in full-time ministry, but I would encourage you to think of the blessedness of seeking the Lord to see if he might be calling you and asking you to do more, to find out his will, to find out where he wants you to be. I'm glad that many of you have got good jobs. We need people to have good jobs, because if you didn't have good jobs, the pastor wouldn't get a salary, for example. We need people who work well and work hard. But the labourers are few. The labourers in the field are few. And Jesus says, don't put all your effort into getting bread that perishes. Put your effort into the kingdom of God. And then another verse, just to help you and encourage you. So 1 Corinthians 15, 58. 1 Corinthians 15, 58. Therefore, my dear brothers, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. I remember at work, often my labor for my boss was just in vain. I'd work and work and work and work and work, and it was still not good enough. It still wasn't enough. No, there's a bigger target now. There's more to achieve. There's more business to go and get. It's like, can I just rest? No, you can't rest. But what if I do rest? I'll sack you. Okay, welcome to the world of sales, whatever your world was or is. But the work of the Lord, the labor in the Lord, is not in vain. You know, again, just picking on the young people that I can see to my left, many of you are doing, some of you are doing A-levels, some of you are doing GCSE, some of you are getting to that stage. And one of the things, one of the big discussions in our house at the moment with GCSEs right there is, well, what am I looking to do at university with an eye to a career? You know, I wonder whether if I said to any of the young people, how many of you are thinking about full-time Christian work? How many of you would just laugh at that idea? What? Even a giggle. Full-time Christian work. But I would just encourage you guys now, and all of you, to be just praying through God as I think about what it is you want me to do. What do you want me to do for you? Somebody said to me when I was 16, I think it was my youth worker, somebody said to me when I was 16, I reckon one day, Jonathan, you will end up in full-time Christian work. Do you know how I felt? I felt insulted. What do you think? What, you must think I'm really lame then. You must, full-time Christian work. I'm trying to get A-levels here, to go to university, to get a job, drive a nice car. What do you mean? I felt insulted. As a Christian, why would I want to become a pastor or a missionary or something like that? Got to university. Somebody said to me again when I was at university. Somebody prayed over me and said to me at university, I reckon that you will have full-time work for the Lord one day. Now, by then, I was a little bit softer to these things, but I thought, well, what's this all about? I'm working hard here to get an education, to get a good job. What's all this about? Why do people keep seeming to suggest that I'm going to do something in the church or somewhere else in that way? 10 years ago, next month, something like April the 4th, 2008, I walked into the boardroom of the company I was working for and opened the door to what is a big rah-rah razzmatazz celebration as the new financial year at work kicked off. And I walked in and God just said to me, this isn't what you're going to be doing much longer. Clear call on my life to come into Christian ministry.
And you know, I didn't argue with that by that stage. I didn't fight God. I knew he was right. And I wonder whether part of the reason I knew he was right was because from the age of 16, people had started to say to me, are you thinking about work for the kingdom? Are you thinking about investing not in bread that perishes, but in Christian work? And so I just say to you guys over in that corner there, and the other young people around, yeah, you're all very young, but these ones here who are young, properly young, just be open to what I'm saying. Maybe when, because I was 32 10 years ago, maybe when you're 32 or 22 or whatever age, God will say to you, I want you to come and work for me. And it may well be that actually tonight is just the start of the Holy Spirit sowing a seed in your life, or maybe somebody else in this room, to say, think about where you're investing your time. Think about what you're doing, because there's more to life than a good degree, a good job, and then you die. I'm not saying don't work hard. My children especially, you can hear that. And no, I'm not saying that. Don't go home and tell your mum that's what I said. I'm simply saying, always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labour in the Lord is not in vain. So in conclusion, verses 24 to 26, the conclusion is, the solution is, don't get stressed. Enjoy life under the sun. I thought Solomon had done the enjoying of life and had found out that that was meaningless and pointless, and I wasn't supposed to enjoy life. No, that's not what he's saying. Remember last week I said he's not moralizing, he's theologizing. He's not saying it's bad to have good things, it's bad to have a good life. He's just saying, where is God in your plans and in your life? Enjoy life. Look at verse 24. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. Phew. I'm allowed to enjoy food. I'm allowed to enjoy drink. I'm even allowed to enjoy my work. As long as I realize that enjoyment comes from God. Do you see what it says there? A man can do nothing better than to enjoy God. This is the last little illustration, the last little point tonight. There's a perspective in that nothing better. There's a perspective in that nothing better. There's a good perspective of nothing better, and there's a bad perspective of nothing better, or maybe I should say a wise perspective and a foolish perspective of the nothing better. When I was at university, the main building at university up in Middlesbrough was a 10-story tower block, a really huge tower block, 10 stories high in Middlesbrough. It was, I think, the highest building in the town, probably. And you would climb up to the top of this building, and you would have incredible views. Middlesbrough's up in North Yorkshire. You could go to one side of the tower block, the University of Teesside tower block, and you could look out over, well, I can't remember what this way we'll say it was, and you would see the rolling countryside of North Yorkshire. You'd see Rosebery Topping in Great Ayton. You'd see the sea over that way on a clear day. It was just a beautiful aspect, a beautiful perspective on this side of what was called Middlesbrough Tower, the main building of the main campus of the university I was at. But if you walked all the way around to the other side of the building and you looked over this way, your view would be immediately downwards to some of the poorest, most squalid housing in the United Kingdom. And then you'd look up in the hope that maybe, well, okay, that's pretty grim and dirty and downcast down there. Maybe if I look up, it'll look like Rosebery Topping in Great Ayton and all of those beautiful views. But all you could see as you looked up was the steelworks. And in those days, I don't think it's different now, but in those days, there was just chimney tower after chimney tower bellowing out smoke, and those kind of big things, pylons with fire just burning out all the time, glowing orange all over the place. There's a different perspective depending upon whether you're looking that way or that way. There's a different perspective depending upon whether you're looking at life under the sun or above the sun. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. There's a perspective to the nothing better.
Everything in verse 24 that Solomon says is okay to enjoy, food, drink, life, work, is true for a Christian. It's enjoyable. But the view of the nothing better from a non-Christian perspective is pretty bleak, like the industrial northeast of England. If the nothing better is only about eating and drinking, that is very, very depressing. Solomon is saying, young people in particular, if your motto is live life to the full because you're going to die, that's grim. It's meaningless. Rather, enjoy life to the full, knowing that heaven is real. And so he finishes with verse 26, where he says, to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. He's a little bit cynical here, is Solomon, because he's saying, you know, sinful people are going to hand over all their goods to God people. They have the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. You know what? It's not kind of what Solomon knows. The truth here is we don't store up treasure on earth. It's not about waiting for bad people to die, a bit of karma coming round, you know, that we might get their stuff. Our eyes are on heaven. But it seems to me that the question that he's asking there in verse 26 is that as Christians, particularly in a nation like ours or a place like Solomon's, the palace of Israel, we are really blessed. What are we going to do with God, with what God has given us? Where are we going to invest our time, our talent, and our treasure? Let's sing, shall we?